Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The news today is Ebola and European banks and the coming fight in mobile payments. The feature stories are How Your Economy Looks to You and our series I've Always Wondered. A couple of other things thrown in there as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today the 27th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us. Casey Hickox, the nurse quarantined over the weekend by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie over Ebola fears, walked out of her isolation tent at University Hospital of Newark this afternoon. She got into a car and drove away. Maine is her reported destination. There may or may not be quarantine time in her future once she gets there. But either way, the questions that her case raises haven't gone away. Those questions are in part public safety, part logistics, part politics, and part HR as well, human resources. Because how do groups like Doctors Without Borders, for whom Hickox had volunteered, how do they get the healthcare workers who are urgently needed to contain the outbreak to go where the outbreak is when there is such an uncertain environment for them to come home to? There are lots of moving parts in this story. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains.
Money and equipment are on the way. The U.S. and Britain have both pledged to build Ebola treatment centers in West Africa, but will they be staffed up? Asked U.N. spokesperson Nika Alexander.
From the beginning of the outbreak until now, it has been difficult to find people who have the experience, the willingness, and the flexibility. It's not an easy ask.
The World Health Organization says despite countries including Cuba, China, and Ethiopia sending health teams, several hundred more foreign medical workers are needed. Don't forget Guinea, with the highest proportion of doctors among the three West African nations, has 10 physicians per 100,000 people. The U.S. has 240. Everyone agrees the way to keep the American public safe is to beat this virus over there. But who? Who should step up? These are some sticky issues, so I called up Johns Hopkins bioethicist Zachary Berger, who's also an epidemiologist, more than qualified to do this work.
I have obligations to my patients. I have obligations to my family. I think I would do most good here.
Berger's not alone. Lots of healthcare workers aren't going. Maybe they worry about getting sick or wonder whether they'll have the right skills or think they'll be treated like a pariah when they come back. Boston University's Dr. Nahid Badelia is one of the people trying to round up doctors to go. One way she does that is by telling stories, like the one about an old man in Sierra Leone.
I went back in to see if there's someone to help me move him. And the minute I walked into the ward, his mother walked up to me with her six-month-old and said, "This baby's not feeling well. Can you help me?" And by the time I was done taking care of the child, the old man was already dead.
The intimacy and immediacy of that anecdote certainly gave Dr. Berger at Hopkins pause after I mentioned it during our interview.
It's stories like that that make people, you know, shift how they see their obligation.
Maybe Berger, too. It moved him enough that now he wants to get in touch with Dr. Badelio. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A moment now for the global banking system, by which I mean, to be just a bit more accurate, the European slice of the global banking system. Regulators over there have been stress testing about 130 of the euro area's biggest banks to see how healthy, or more accurately, how unhealthy they are, wanting to avoid unpleasant surprises. The ECB, the European Central Bank, released the results over the weekend. The BBC's Jonathan Frewin is here to discuss. Jonathan, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too, Kai.
I want to know how this is playing over there, because I will tell you the story in the New York Times about this article said just 13 banks fail ECB stress tests, as if, not that big a deal. How's it playing over there?
Well, I noticed that the American headlines seem to be far more optimistic, and the European ones, maybe it's part of our cultural differences, were a bit more pessimistic. But actually, there were 24 that did originally fail. 10 of those have subsequently shored up their finances. So I think there are some big questions that need to be answered. None of the British banks failed. Mm-hmm. Lloyds, which was bailed out by the government, still owned a quarter by the government today, led only narrowly passed, so its shares were down 2%. But there are big problems in banks elsewhere. I mean, there's one notably in Italy.
Right, that's the one I wanted to ask you about. Monte dei Paschi, I think. I can't even pronounce it right. It's the oldest continuously running bank in the world, and now it's in trouble, it seems?
Well, that's the one that caught my eye as well. It's not just because of the difficulty pronouncing it. I think it's Monte dei Paschi. it was founded in 1472. It's the world's oldest bank, at least, that's still in existence. It failed the test worse than any of the others, and its shares fell 17% in early trading. Trading was suspended, and it needs $2.5 billion to shore up its finances. But Italy seems to be the loser in all of this. 9 of the 130 that were originally tested failed the test. 4 still have to raise finances, and that's more than any of the other countries in the Eurozone.
The global economy question here is whatever happens over there eventually affects all of us, right?
Well, I suppose that's the case, but you know, we're so interconnected that whatever happens there can boost confidence here in Europe and vice versa.
Well, we're doing what we can, man. Jonathan Frewin at the BBC. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Kai.
The age of frictionless mobile payments is upon us, or maybe it's not. Last week, those of you with spiffy new iPhones could have used the spiffy new Apple Pay system to make purchases at your local Rite Aids and CVSs. This week, no Apple Pay for you. Those chains have pulled the plug, saying only that they are still evaluating mobile payment options for their customers. See also, quote, "we want a slice of that market," end quote. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson breaks down what it means for each side.
This whole taking Apple Pay and then not taking Apple Pay, Deborah Baxley says it was a really bad move for CVS and Rite Aid. She's a payments consultant with Capgemini.
It's already having an effect because the Twitterverse is exploding with disgruntled Apple Pay customers. So I think these merchants are effectively shooting themselves in the foot.
But she says the impact will likely be more reputational, less bottom line. As for Apple, it might serve to remind them that he who controls the cash register controls the sale, says Mary Monahan, the head of mobile at Javelin Strategy and Research.
Apple Pay doesn't offer loyalty, doesn't give the merchant anything to bring the customer back into the store. So Apple is going to need to add that to really sweeten the pot for these merchants to turn on Apple Pay.
All CVS and Rite Aid will say is that they're still evaluating different mobile payment technologies. They're also a part of the Merchant Customer Exchange, which is developing its own payment system called Currency. So many analysts believe these stores are blocking Apple Pay to wait for that launch in 2015. Bai Ling Yin researches the mobile industry at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research.
The best thing you can do if you're waiting for your system to come online and be a competitor is to make sure that there is as much hesitation on the part of consumers to adopt that new standard as possible to buy yourself time so that you can actually compete.
She says a bad move for Rite Aid and CVS might be the right move for Currency. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Not a whole lot of movement at all on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the joy the internet brings us, there is a phenomenon that social media companies run into, Facebook and YouTube and all the rest of them, that is broadly referred to as the grandma problem. In a way, it's a good problem to have, because as the internet has gone mainstream, even grandma is on Facebook, right? But that means the really disgusting stuff that can show up there and elsewhere is a big no-no for companies that want to hang on to grandma and her business. So enter the content moderator, the people who make sure the really icky stuff the internet has to offer does not show up next to the family pictures that grandma logged on to see. How do they do that? Well, they do it by looking at the really icky stuff the internet has to offer all day, every day. Adrian Chen wrote about these people. They are called content moderators for the latest issue of Wired magazine. Adrian, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is going to be a tricky conversation because I cannot even read the title of your article in Wired about content moderation on the radio, or the FCC will get really mad at me.
Well, that's one great thing about the internet.
Well, that's right. Give me a sense of scale then, right? I mean, how many people are employed, you know, keeping objectionable content off Facebook or whatever else it is versus who actually work at Facebook or someplace else?
Well, it's really hard to estimate how many people do this because it's very secretive. People have to sign non-disclosures when they do this, and companies really don't like to talk about it for kind of obvious reasons. I talked to one expert who said that he estimated, you know, well over 100,000 people are doing this worldwide, and that's about 14 times the size of Facebook.
It's the vilest of the vilest pornography. It's the most disturbing of all hate speech. I mean, it's really bad, bad stuff.
Yeah, it's basically kind of the worst of humanity that you can imagine. You know, the internet has this reputation of presenting, you know, the best and the worst, and this is definitely the worst.
And who are these people who work in this business? You went out to the Philippines. A lot of it is outsourced.
Yeah, the Philippines is kind of the hotbed for content moderation. What the companies told me was that people in the Philippines, because of the cultural connection to the U.S., were kind of better equipped to screen content for American and Western audiences.
And they do it cheaper, too.
Yeah. You know, I talked to one guy who made $500 a month. He was offered a job at a firm screening Facebook content for what he said was around $315 a month. That's way less than somebody would make in the U.S.
What does it do, though, to people who do this 8 hours a day sitting in a monitor looking at this horrible, horrible stuff? It can't be good for them.
No, it's definitely not good for them, and the effects vary, but I think one of the most widespread things is that people just get kind of a darker view of humanity. That's what one guy who screened content for Google told me. Another is paranoia. People are scared to leave their kids at home because they see this kind of horrible child abuse all day. And some people who have to look at just even legal porn all day get kind of lower libidos, or they say their sex drive is supercharged. I mean, it's just kind of seeing all this abnormal stuff all day, I think, really kind of gives you a twisted view of what's going on out there.
The volume must be unbelievable. I mean, if, you know, there are a billion people on Facebook, for crying out loud.
Yeah, these people are seeing definitely 10,000, 20,000 images a day, depending on what kind of moderation they're doing. Not all of them are really horrible images, yeah. But one person I talked to actually said the fact that it's only sporadic actually makes it kind of worse because you're always dreading when you're going to see, you know, somebody get beheaded or something in between all these regular pictures.
Has this made you think more about your social network feeds?
Yeah, I think it makes me realize that, you know, it's not just me and the people who are seeing the stuff that I post. There's this kind of layer of invisible human labor that is shaping what is going on your screen.
Adrian Chen, his article, the title of which I cannot repeat on this radio program, about content moderation on the internet, is in the new Wired magazine. Adrian, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
So look, you can take your GDP and your unemployment rate and your consumer price index and you can chuck them, because arguably the most important economic indicator out there is yours, how your economy is doing. We've been asking you that question the past couple of weeks. Here is Linda Hall. She is from Evanston, Illinois.
I lost my job in 2008, along with, I think, half of the U.S. population, it felt like. It was a very, very difficult time to lose your job. I had well-meaning family members telling me that I was never going to be able to get another job because I was on the verge of being 50 at that point. And I can remember, I watched a lot of Disney Channel. I just couldn't watch anything that was serious because it was too depressing. It was too difficult. I knew everything that you could ever want to know about Hannah Montana, because even at that point, HGTV had me looking around my house thinking about how I was never going to be able to sell because the market was bad and I had no design theme in my house. Most of the people that I know who are my age have been let go, and a lot of them are consulting now. consulting is a very, very feast or famine way to earn a living. And I fought very hard against being a consultant. It was something that I did in order to make ends meet, but it wasn't something that I did because I had a burning desire to do it. And I've become more resigned to being a consultant. I'm still in my house. I can still pay my mortgage, but it's the unanticipated expenses that are really, really difficult now.
Take a second or a minute or however long you want, really, and tell us how your economy is doing. There's a spot on our homepage where you can do that. It is, of course, marketplace.org. Coming up.
I did not realize that passengers got rated. The driver said, tip five to get five.
Writer Delia Ephron on some of the numbers that rule her world. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 12 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 16,817. The NASDAQ very nearly flat, added just 2 points, 44.85. The S&P 500 slipped 2 points, a 10% down, finished at 1961. Oil dipped below $80 a barrel, that after Goldman Sachs forecast even lower prices. Good news perhaps for Chevrolet's 8-cylinder Camaro, which gets 14 miles to the gallon. Not good news for oil refiners, which have big fixed costs as they produce cheaper and cheaper gas. Marathon Oil lost 4.3%. Today, Phillips 66 fell 1.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.25%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on interest rates. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for September. A refrigerator is a good example of a durable good. Halloween candy is not. And speaking of candy, this almost seems too good to be true. Tomorrow is Chocolate Day. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We take your questions every now and then about some of the little things in the world of business and the economy that might have been bugging you over the years. It's our series called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Today's question, or questions, I suppose, come from Arvella Collins in Columbia, Maryland.
I've always wondered how actors are paid residuals from shows they've recorded. And is it enough to support a family? What is syndication, and does that impact their residuals?
Marketplace's Tommy Andres is on it.
Well, thankfully, Arvella, for you and the Marketplace budget, I happen to be in sunny Southern California, the official home of television. Now, first stop on our quest for answers, the Warner Brothers studio tour in Burbank. Our guide is Ryan.
Okie doke, how's everybody doing today?
We hop on a golf cart, and he takes us around the studio's back lots, the front lots, and into here.
This is the Central Perk Cafe from Friends.
And that's when it hits me. Friends is the perfect show to tackle residuals. It's on all the time, all over the world.
Hola, amigos.
So when we get back in the golf cart, I ask Ryan how that happens.
Exclusivity, for example, for something like Friends, there's going to be like a 6 to 9 month period where only NBC can air that episode. But after that time is up, we're free to sell it to CW or TBS or foreign channels. And that's really how we end up making most of our money on these shows. Money we sell.
I call Arvella up to tell her what I've learned so far and to ask her a question. So Arvella, I figured out what syndication is, but to get the rest of your answers, I need to pick a show. So what's your favorite?
My favorite show is Good Times.
Okay, what's your second favorite show?
King of Queens.
Just say Friends, Arvella. Come on.
My all-time favorite show is Friends.
Perfect. That's great. So, since Arvella's favorite show is indeed Friends, I pull some strings, call in a few favors, and suddenly I'm sitting not in the Central Perk, but the Beechwood Cafe in Hollywood, across the table from one of the show's biggest stars.
Gunther.
Gunther's real name is James Michael Tyler, but he goes by Michael. And his story is the quintessential Hollywood dream come true.
I moved to Los Angeles in 1988.
He worked in a coffee shop to make ends meet.
As a barista.
And one day, he got a call from a pal.
He said, there's this new show starting up, and there's a coffee house set in it, and the producers are looking for someone who can operate an espresso machine. So I showed up the next day, and it was like one day of work as an extra, and they called me back the next week. And that continued for about, I'd say, a year and a half.
Michael made $45 a day.
And then Marta Kaufman, who was one of the executive producers and creators of the show, walked up to me one afternoon and said, do you have any acting experience? And I said, as a matter of fact, I do. I have a Master of Fine Arts in acting. And she handed me a script and she said, you now have a name. You're no longer just Coffee Guy. Your character's name is Gunther. And you have a line of dialogue in this episode. And it's, yeah.
Hey, Gunther, you got stairs in your place?
Yeah.
Go nuts.
Michael got $1,200 for the line. Not a bad raise, but it got even better.
About 6 months later, during the summer when they repeated that episode, there was a check, and it was for almost the full amount that I got paid the first time.
So you made close to $2,400 for just saying the word yeah.
Yeah.
Good answer. Not bad, right? And the checks for that yeah kept coming. But he got less and less every time it aired.
It's a sliding scale, which goes further and further, further and down until now I can get, a nice thick envelope in the mail sometimes, open it up, I'll say, oh, it's a residual check. And at times, the amount of the check is less than the postage to send that big envelope.
What's the smallest residual check you've ever gotten?
I believe it was for 9 cents.
$1,200 to 9 cents. Now, that's some crazy math. To help us break it down, I went to visit this guy.
My name is Craig Beatty. I'm the Vice President of Residuals and Account Management at Entertainment Partners.
Craig's company serves as the middleman between entertainment companies and the Screen Actors Guild. That's the actors' union. He says no actor gets more than a couple $1,000 an episode for a network rerun.
Regardless of the money they were being paid, there was a cap.
And when a show is syndicated, an actor starts getting a portion of that rate for every play.
Starts at 40%, down to 30%, and tails off at 5%.
Michael was in 148 episodes of Friends, so these days he gets that 5% every time one airs in North America, which means if you see his yeah today, he's getting a check for $60. Those 9 cent checks he talked about are for stuff like DVD sales and digital media. So altogether, is it enough to live on?
I don't live a really extravagant lifestyle. I still rent my house. I'm going to be known as Gunther for the rest of my life. For good or bad. So I was like, I better put this away because I know it's going to be a tough road ahead to, kind of shake that persona.
So the answer in a way is...
Yeah.
I'm Tommy Andres for Marketplace.
All of our answers to all your awesome I've Always Wondered questions live online at marketplace.org. The national tour of our road show, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers, was in New York City a couple of weeks ago, and we had on stage with us at the 92nd Street Y a consummate New Yorker and worrier, Delia Ephron. Her most recent book is called Sister, Mother, Husband, Dog, Etc. And we talked a little bit about life in the big city and specifically how she gets around sometimes in an Uber. Here you go, Delia Ephron.
I was riding uptown in an Uber car. And the driver said to me, you have a 4.5 rating. If it drops to 4.0, no one will pick you up.
Okay? Ryan, what do you do?
A perfect rating is 5. So, and by this time I had only taken like 4 rides in an Uber car, okay? So then I got obsessed. I thought, what have I done to cause this? Maybe I'm just the rudest person in America. So I had to review all of my rides. The time I got into an argument in an Uber car.
And you can just see these guys with
Brooklyn.
Their phones going, that's a 3.2.
Right.
I'm not doing that.
I did not realize that passengers got rated. The driver said, tip 5 to get 5.
Wait, now you have to tell me what that means.
Tip.
You guys
five,
all know what that means.
You don't
tip,
know. Okay,
no.
Tip $5.
Oh, 5
to get
bucks
a,
to get 5 stars?
To 5, yeah.
I'm clearly an Uber Rube. Wow.
But then I got panicked because there's nothing worse than being someone who doesn't tip.
I thought you were. I totally thought
I
you were supposed to tip
the driver.
Yeah,
5. I hope I got
and,
5.
And, yeah, well, you
yeah.
If you didn't, then you got played. Is it? I want to ask you about your sister for a second because she is the your most recent book, Sister, Mother, Husband, Dog, etc. She is the sister in that title. Or I guess you are the sister. I want to talk about collaboration and this idea of taking two and making one, right? Because you guys became a team. How do you do that? Does it happen because you were sisters?
Nora always said that we shared half a brain.
Yeah.
And she had the numbers brain, by the way. I did not. I can't do numbers at all. Well, she was great with the stock market, except she told me to sell my Apple stock 4 years ago.
No, boy, did she.
Yeah, I know.
As she was in the hospital, you guys were writing a cable TV pilot about what? About the SEC, some woman at the SEC and a guy who was an investment banker?
An SEC investigator and then like the head of a huge investment firm. Right. And she's assigned to, but I left, you know, the Dodd-Frank parts and all those
and the
things
short selling
that mean
and all
nothing
that stuff
to me. I left that to Nora, which is, by the way, the great thing about collaborating, which is that you don't need to know everything. You just need to know a certain number of things. Mm-hmm. If they know those things, you don't need to. Yeah. So it's really fantastic.
I wonder if, just to get to the theme of the evening, about learning to stop worrying, not necessarily about the numbers, but in general, seems to me you never stop worrying.
That's true. That's true. I am not someone
you
want
right?
seated in the exit row of an airplane. I just want to say that. I go from 0 to 100 faster than anyone you've ever met.
I will totally sit next to you the next time we're on an airplane. Delia Ephron, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I would sit next to her, too. She was great. The next and final stop for How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers is right here in Los Angeles, Saturday, November the 8th. Me on stage with Amy Poehler and Norman Lear. Also, Gwynne Shotwell, the president of SpaceX. Tickets at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in keeping with the epidemiological nature of where we started, a study by the American Society for Microbiology showed that if somebody with a cold touches an office doorknob, within 4 hours, that virus is found on the hands of half of the people who work in that office. The most contaminated surface? Go ahead, guess. Anybody? All right, it's the coffee pot. Go figure that out. That, by the way, also is not how you can catch Ebola, just to make sure we're all clear on that. All right, we got to go. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.